Mr. Evans, real one. When and where were you born, Mr. Evans?
I was born in the village of Herworth, near Darlington.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father worked in the rolling mills in South Wales, the tin plate mills. I was born on December the 23rd, 1919. My mother, Grace Hutchinson, came from a family of farm workers, and my father originated from the small town of Britton Ferry in the county of Glamorgan, South Wales. All the men of his family, father, uncles, brother, cousins, earned their living in the tin plate rolling mills, which were the staple industry of the town. Work in the rolling mills was arduous and the hours long. 6 12-hour shifts per week. Namely, 6 in the morning till 6 at night one week, and 6 at night till 6 in the morning the next, and so on. Sunday was a rest day. My grandfather, David Evans, was a member of the Britton Ferry Silver Prize Band. He could play the tenor horn, the French horn, and the viola. He taught all his sons to play brass instruments, and as a result, my father, David James Evans, became a very competent euphonium player. He played solo euphonium in the band at Crystal Palace at the age of 16. My father had joined the band of the 7th Welsh Regiment, Territorial Division, in the years leading up to the Great War. He was a member of a cyclist battalion, and when war against Germany was declared in 1914, found himself stationed briefly at Berwick-on-Tweed and subsequently at Saltburn-by-the-Sea, North Yorkshire. The battalion was responsible for patrolling the coast from Redcar down to Whitby. The band members had been dispersed, as in time of war, band men become stretcher bearers. However, it was soon decided that the morale would be best served if the band were reformed. Consequently, the musicians were recalled to Saltburn and issued were their instruments, which my father said were a right load of old scrub. In the meantime, my mother, who had, by hard work, qualified as a school teacher. Unfortunately, she had contracted a tubercular gland in the neck. This was caught, I understand, from some similarly afflicted children in her class at school at Darlington. Whatever the reason, after a lengthy stay in hospital, my mother was sent to a convalescent home in Saltburn to recuperate. That, very briefly, is how they met. In 1916, right in the middle of the war, my father became time expired and was discharged. It is not widely remembered that conscription was not introduced in the early years of the First World War because of the ready influx of willing volunteers.
Did your father talk to you about his involvement in the war?
Not a great deal. My mother talked more about the war because she had met a lot of the farm lads. That she lived in the country, the other side of Darlington, and a lot of the farm workers joined, willing volunteers in the first year or two. And also, she used to play the piano for dancing sometimes, and she used to meet a lot of the forces at these dances. So she knew a lot about the background to it, these young men who went up, and many of them were killed, and they were all simple-minded farm workers and patriotic. So they began to run out of volunteers in 1916. Just as a by-note, the 7th Welsh Battalion was stationed at Saltburn for 4 years before finally moving to Seton Carew. Being unable to settle to civilian life, my father volunteered once more and was posted this time to another unit of the Welsh Regiment at Holt in Norfolk, and naturally he became a bandsman. At one stage, the band used to parade the troops down to embarkation points at Southampton, and my father said he could have spent the rest of the war doing that, but he didn't relish that idea, so he volunteered for overseas. Initially, he was posted to Egypt, and he embarked at Marseille on the troop ship Transylvania. Their departure had been duly observed by German agents who were disguised as Corsican fishermen. Before the vessel had gone very far, it was struck by a torpedo from a lurking German U-boat, and it began to settle in the water. The troops were assembled on deck in a natural state of alarm and uncertainty. My father remembers an officer who drew his revolver and shouted, "The first man that moves, I'll blow his bloody head off." And thus was any incipient panic averted. Eventually, my father found himself struggling in the water. Some of his comrades were caught by the propellers of the Japanese destroyers. In those days, Japan was on our side, and the two escorting destroyers picked up as many men as they could. At the same time, they were firing on the German submarine. And my father was crowded on the gun deck below the guns, and because of the detonation, it burst his eardrum. In due course, he had to go to the military hospital in Newcastle in 1926, and he was there for several months while the whole of his right eardrum was removed. So although he looked normal from the outside, his ear was packed with cotton wool, which had to be cleaned out every so many months. This made him unable to walk steadily, and people were inclined to think he was drunk as he staggered about. It also meant he couldn't climb anymore at his work at ICI Billingham, and he was given a light duty job as a change room attendant, and he stayed there for the rest of his working life.
When he was rescued, what happened to him then? Did he continue? Well, he wouldn't be in any state, and he would be in hospital with his ears, was he?
No. I think this developed over the years. And he got understood he had three double mastoids. Now, I don't know what that exactly means at the end. But I remember going up in 1926 with my mother to the military hospital in Newcastle. And all the men wore hospital blue, and there were men there with no arms, no legs, blind, still years and years after the war. And that's when my father had this operation. And he was awarded a pension, war pension on that.
So after the sinking, what happened to him?
Right, now then. You see, you wish when you get older that you'd ask more questions when you were young. But my father did end up in Egypt, because he said he used to swim in the Sweetwater Canal, wherever that is, and also he said they used to get men bitten by scorpions, and they could see them running for the first aid centre, you know, to be treated. He also ended up in Palestine, because he remembers seeing the Indian troops attacking the Turkish positions, and scrambling up this hill and being cut to pieces by the Turks' artillery and machine gun fire. And then later on he came back and he was in the trenches in France, where he caught trench fever, was gassed, and still, until the day he died, remembered his comrades on the barbed wire. He said, "I think of them still." And he was invalided home. He landed at Southampton, and they said, "Where do you live?" And he said, "South Wales." So they sent him to a military hospital at Halifax. So that's it. Now then, to go back to where they met. My mother used to meet him at dances. My father was not a very good dancer, very unsocial. So that if my mother danced with another soldier, he used to go on sulk in the cloakroom, you see. And then other times he'd be in the Alexandra vaults with his pals. I remember they used to say they'd be singing, "We are three jolly boys all in a row," and she'd be pacing up and down outside waiting for him to come out. But she had other soldier friends there, and at Darlington, and nothing serious in those days, it wasn't. And when my father was sent overseas, he sent a letter to my mother saying, will you write to me? And she wasn't going to bother. And her father said, oh, send the poor lad a letter. And so she did. And that's how it started. And from then on, every week she sent him a letter and a box of cigarettes. And sometimes he didn't get those for weeks at a time, and then he'd get several all in one go. So at the end of the war, 1919, they got married. In fact, they got married in 1918, because he came home. I don't know where he was stationed then, but he was still in uniform. And at that time, my mother's father was caretaker of Thorpe Hall, near Barnet Castle. This was a house owned by Mrs. de Landlong, who was one of the Dorman Long family, and she was very rarely there. So my grandfather was caretaker. I think it's now called Walton Lido or something of that sort. And I remember my father went into Barnet Castle to buy the wedding ring, and of course he used to drink a lot in those days, as all steel workers used to do, and they saw him coming over through the fields on his bike and falling off regularly on the way back. But eventually they married, and they were married at Wycliffe Parish Church, because they went there from Thorpe Hall in horse and carriage, and as they went through the fields, the German prisoners of war waved to them because they'd become friendly with them as they were working there, and so they were married, and that's how their married life began.
How many children did they have?
They only had me initially, and then 1931, when I was 10 and a half, my mother said to me, how would you like a little brother, you see? I didn't know what she was talking about, and that's when I think the fairies must have brought my brother along. So that was it. There were just the two of us.
So where were you living when you were born?
They were living at Hurworth. My mother's uncle was called Uncle Jack Crisp, and he was a well-known market gardener at Hurworth, a big employer in the district. And there was a house called Bridge House, there's an iron bridge goes across from Hurworth to the other side, the Yorkshire side, and there was a bridge house, and I was born there.
And what kind of neighbourhood was it?
Just a small village, Hurworth.
Country village.
Country village, because my mother's parents were all farm workers, grooms, farm servants, etc.
And did you grow up as a child in that house?
Oh, no. No. My mother's background, she came from a large family, rather poor, and her uncle David and his wife Emma were unable to have children because she had rheumatic fever. And so my mother was brought up at Cleasby near Darlington by them. So she was brought up as an only child. So for years and years, I was 14 years old before I was told that my grandparents weren't really my grandparents. My grandmother was a lady called Granny Alice at Hurworth, who I knew vaguely as a shadowy figure in the background, but I had no idea she was my real grandma.
Where did you spend most of your childhood? Where were you living?
Right. Well, what happened was, naturally, my mother went down to South Wales. So by the time I was 18 months old, I'd been down and back to South Wales 3 times, so my mother said. And I remember my second Christmas was in South Wales, in my grandfather's house, and there was a family in each room, because we had a large family, and we had the front room. And I remember waking up one day and being told it was Christmas. We all slept in one single bed in the front room, the three of us. And that's the first time I knew about Christmas. And my mother didn't believe that I could remember as far back as that until I told her a few more things about the trains going past, etc., and how I used to kneel on this box and watch the trains going past. And then she realised I did remember it. But she couldn't settle in South Wales, a different way of life altogether, drinking and all living in the industrial atmosphere. And she'd been brought up as a country school teacher as an only child. So they came back up to the northeast, to Darlington. And my father got work in the rolling mills at Faverdale, which I think is past Cockerton in Darlington. And my mother got a rooms in a Victoria Embankment. So wherever my father went, my mother had to go knocking on doors to find a room. After he left Faverdale, he went down to a place called Port Mulgrave. And there they were importing iron ore. So my father used to be working, and he found it very, very hard work. And these Cleveland country people were very, very tough and hardy. And he had a job keeping up with them, although he wasn't a weakling himself. But he used to, waiting for them, walking along the cliff top, Fort Mulgrave. He used to wish they'd never come because it was such hard graft. So then, eventually, they moved to Stockton, and they got a job in the rolling mills, the Bosfield rolling mills, Bosfield Lane. And once again, my mother had to knock on doors. And she found a room in Parliament Street. Once again, there was a family in each room. It was a normal thing in those days. And the man who owned it was Mr. Tyerman. He was an upholsterer. And he and his family, wife and two daughters, lived in the back of this terrace house. And there was a family in all the other rooms in the house. We had a bed sitting room upstairs. So when my father was working on night shift, I had to sit quietly on a chair for several hours and not speak. And if I had to move, tiptoe about so it didn't wake my father. And also, steel workers drink a lot because in the nature of the work, they sweat it all out of them with the intense heat. And it's no good drinking water because you're losing salts and minerals, and you have to replace that, and beer is the thing that does it. But of course it causes a lot of drunkenness as well. So my mother had got my father weaned off the beer, and she used to make in this big bowl Dr. Watson's Home Brewed Stout, which is non-alcoholic. It probably tasted horrible, but that's what the poor chap had to take to work. So we lived in Parliament Street until I was three. And my memories of those are the Sunday, the Boys Brigade band coming down Parliament Street with the bugles and drums and the pillbox hats on the back of their heads. And also wash days. And every yard had an old mangle in. And Monday was a classic wash day. And the whole area used to echo with this tubs thumping, the post stick and a post tub. Monday was the day for washing. So that was it. And I remember going to the cinema once, the Empire Cinema, and there was a film on called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And my mother was taken ill in the queue and we had to come back. My mother was a very nervous disposition. So in due course, they were allocated a council house on Blue Hall Estate in Norton. It was the first council estate to be built, and they were given the key of the house. This is very important, giving the key. In Esk Road, all the roads were named after rivers, northern rivers, so Esk Road, Greeter Road, Leven Road, and so on. So they moved into this kitchen house. It was called a kitchen house because there was one big living room and a kitchen at the back. But it was wonderful. It was their first home, and they'd only been in a few weeks, and the wall between the living room and the kitchen began to disintegrate, and the workmen had to come in and put up a great big green tarpaulin, and we lived behind that for a while till the wall was rebuilt. It was an example of jerry building. But the rent was 15 shillings a week, and the other side of the street was being built, of Esk Road, and there used to be rows of tumbrils. They were the big two-wheeled carts, horse-drawn, that used to carry the clay along, and the drivers would sit on top smoking the clay pipes as they went along, and that side was built. So eventually Blue Hall was completed, and my father still worked at Bosfield, but lots of people were working at ICI, Billingham, Imperial Chemical Industries. This had been a munitions factory in the First World War, and it was taken over by Brunemond, who then became ICI, and the founder was sitting on this huge vein of anhydrous stone, which was used for making sulfuric acid. And I believe it goes right from Teesside right across into Cumbria, and there's another chemical company in Cumbria also use this stone. So there were 10,000 men on construction work on Teesside at ICI Billingham, and next door to us the chief labour clerk, Mr. Bywater, lived, and he was instrumental in getting my father a job on construction at ICI. So on Blue Hall Estate, half the fathers worked in ICI and the other half were mostly unemployed.
Was it a good neighbourhood? Did you get on well with your neighbours?
Oh yes, it was young families and big gardens, much bigger than they could allow today because they need the density of housing, but in those days they had long gardens, and some men became very keen gardeners, other people just didn't know how to cope with it. But yes, young families, and most of the houses where I lived had one or two children, all about my age group. And I was an only child, and I used to envy these who had a brother or a sister, you know, because you didn't feel so alone then if you had somebody at school that belonged to you. Well, I didn't. So yes, it was a respectable district. So what else can I say? When I was five, I went to Norton Board School. I remember my mother taking me along to Norton High Street to the school arch and handing me over to a big girl. I think she was all of 11. She was called Doris Richardson. And she took my hand and led me into the school and left me with the infant teacher. And that's when my schooling started, in 1925.
Did you enjoy school life?
No, I didn't. I was always pleased to leave school. But we went through the usual routine. We played with plasticine and made birds' nests with it, and we had various little construction toys, very simple ones we used to make, and then we used to have to march into the classroom, and then we'd to the tune of the piano. The teacher used to play a march on the piano. But we had to sit up straight and not talk, fold our arms in front of us, and nobody had to speak, and we were very well behaved. And then in due course I went into the junior school, and we were taught that at the age of 7, 8 and 9 how to write proper joined up writing very carefully, how to print, and we were also taught vulgar fractions and decimals. We not only did decimals, we did the imperial measure as well. We did them both. And when I was 10, the population of Norton had expanded, and they built another school called the Frederick Natras School, which was on Blue Hall, and it was named after Alderman Natras, who was a potato merchant. And there we had an assembly hall, and we had a science lab, and an art room. It was, you know, state of the art in 1930. Very, very strict. When the cane and the strop was used all the time, and if the teacher couldn't cane you hard enough, he'd send you up to the headmaster, Walter Morland, who was even more severe on you, so you didn't want to get sent there. But we were very well behaved, and you can imagine why.
Did sport come into your life when you were at school?
Yes, once a week we used to go into the recreation ground to play football, and that was it. And the rest of the time, of course, we played on our own in the recreation ground.
So. And had you set any examinations at any stage of your education?
Well, of course, when we got to 11, we sat the 11 plus. And my mother was very assiduous in coaching me, having been a school teacher, wanting me to get on a bit. And I passed the scholarship for Stockton Secondary School and also for Stockton Grammar School, which was a fee-paying school but had 7 foundation scholarships a year and 1 Norton scholarship. And the Norton scholarship was founded by Norton Church, and you had to take an extra scripture exam. And it so happened I knew the answer to this question. I was able to give them a little essay on the scripture, so I was awarded the Norton scholarship. So I said to the headmaster, Mr. Morland, which one shall I take, sir? He said, well, I think I will go to the grammar school, Evans. And so that's what happened.
And your memories of the grammar school, what were they?
Oh, well, it's a big subject, is this. Majority of the pupils there were sons of professional men, doctors, solicitors, bank managers, etc. Quite a few farmers sent their sons to the grammar school. And it wasn't until after I'd left the grammar school, years later, I became aware of the difference between the scholarship boys and the paying pupils. We sat at the front and we worked hard, and we were handed second-hand books from previous ex-pupils. And the other lads used to sit at the back, and most of them used to play about and not take things too seriously. And so the first half dozen positions in the class were always taken by scholarship boys. Great competition between us. And I think we used to think we were a bit superior to these other lads, but it was years later I realised they weren't under the pressure that we were to prove ourselves. Years later, of course, they went into solicitors and became doctors and so on themselves. But although it was a free scholarship, it still cost my parents a great deal, because I had to have a football strip and football boots, a cricket sweater and cricket flannels and spiked cricket boots, school blazer, school tie, school cap, etc. And then they had to contribute towards the drama and to the sports day, etc. So, although I was not aware at the time, it was quite an achievement for my parents. My father was just a light duty man to keep me there. I made some very good friends at the grammar school, and we stayed friends even after we left. 1936, I left.
Did you leave again? Had you took your school certificate, I think it was, in those
yes.
days?
Yes, at 15 we took the school certificate. We took it a year early. The whole class passed 100%. And we also, most of us also matriculated, which was a high standard again. And there were 17 distinctions in that class. It was an exceptional class. And we were only 15. And we could speak French and Latin. And we're very well versed in maths, etc. But I must say that at the Fred Ignatius School, the elementary school, at the age of 10, we were being taught French then.